Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I am here, Alex Kessel, your host, with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's up, guys?
And today we have joining us, Josh Lee Kwai.
How's it?
Josh is, you know, the co-host, host of The Command Cast, our sister podcast over
the
on
Command Zone. Talks
on. Oh, correct. I always say Command Cast. I say it wrong almost
every
time.
Well, our Twitter is at Command Cast,
right.
So a lot of people get that wrong. But if you search for it in iTunes or something, then you need to look for The Command Zone.
Right.
Confusing. Probably poor planning on our part. I'm sorry, everybody.
Don't let Alex off the hook. You got it wrong.
Yeah.
Alex, get it right,
For the first, like, 10 episodes, I would just say Modern Masters at the beginning of every podcast. I edited it out, so all you people there don't know. But every single time, it was like a running joke that I'd mess it up. So today, we are talking about the changes to the PTQ system that was announced earlier this year during the beginning of fall and is coming into place, like, today. Like, today is when, well, as we're recording, the first week of the new season.
Yeah.
And from this point on, there's going to be PPTQs and regional PTQs.
Just awesome.
We need a better name than PPTQ.
Oh, agreed. I think that was the biggest mistake so far.
Pre-TQ?
Yeah. I like that.
Let's champion that.
The pre-TQ. Yeah, I'm down.
Copyright on record.
Here.
TM.
Trademark. Beyond that, we're also going to be talking about black-green mid-range decks, sometimes known as Abzan, sometimes known as Jund, and we'll kind of break that down once we get down to there. First, I do want to mention, Josh, you just top-8ed a PTQ, which is why we're doing the subject today, because you had the experience of what a PTQ is and what it used to be.
Yes, I'm now an expert on all things PTQs.
So, you know, to kind of explain what a PTQ was, it was a tournament that was generally, you know, it used to be around 50 people, but it started becoming very popular and around 100 to 400 people. The winner would get a blue envelope and get to go to the Pro Tour. And that was, you know, any player could show up, win the thing, and become a Pro Tour player.
And the blue envelope included airfare, which is huge.
Yes, generally.
So if you went somewhere exotic and international, and your friend's like, what were you doing over the weekend? You're like, oh, I just was competing to try to win this thing to go to Algeria or something like that. You know, so
there were some in Algeria? Man, mine was only for D.C. I was kind of disappointed. I was like,
making a point, Josh.
I could have won a trip to Algeria. If I knew that, I would have tried way harder.
Okay, so to explain kind of what a PPTQ or a pre-TQ and the regional PTQs are, is instead of having those, you know, one-off tournaments, you're going to have to go to a LGS tournament that will be held by, you know, many local stores, will be 3,000 a season, and win those, and then go to a next tournament called a regional PTQ, and winning that gets you onto the Pro Tour.
You basically have to qualify for the qualifier.
Right, exactly.
Well, it's if you're in the top four, that's the deal.
Yes, true.
If you get to the big tournament, the 132 person or 128 or whatever it is, where all the PTQ winners go, if you're in the top four of that final tournament,
it's under 128 players, top four. Okay. Under 120, over 128 players, top eight.
That's for the regional pre-TQ. Yes, yeah. PTQ. The pre-TQ, you actually have to win that. You have to be first place, right?
Yeah, you have to be first place.
And then you qualify for the regional.
Correct.
In which case, you might have to top four, top eight, depending on attendance.
Mind you, there will be much more of those to try and achieve, and almost every LGS is going to be able to throw in as long as there are a certain level of size of player base, and they'll move forward, and you possibly can
and
win.
Hopefully the pre-TQs will be a little bit smaller than the PTQs are now. Is that the hope?
They're expecting them to be around 40 and 50. Sorry. They're expecting them to be around 40 to 50 players.
We'll see them taper off as things go on. There's going to be a lot of them. It's the same concept as at the beginning of GPTs being a thing. They were, I think, a little bit – you don't see as many people show up at GPTs now. I think as you're experiencing this, a similar phenomenon.
I think during the first season of them, and especially the first couple weeks of them, they'll be huge. I think you'll get 80-plus because people will react to them similar to how they've been reacting to PTQs, not knowing, not realizing, oh, I can make the next 10 that are going to be in my area. There's going to be one every weekend. I don't need to go to the major
one. That's because we live in Los Angeles.
Right, true. In Los Angeles, it's going to be a ton of them. In other cities, though, it's, you know, it's based on how many card stores there are, and you can generally, within your area, make a few, if not just that one.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's true, people will just be eventually become less motivated to go to everyone. The second season, you'd be like, well, I don't need to go every weekend. I'm just going to wait this one out. And so you'll have a lot less shows, and it'll be probably balanced out around 40 players a tournament, which are like the larger size of what pre-release days are.
Right. Yeah, out here we get pre-releases. They're like 60 people, so it actually could be smaller than a pre-release.
Possibly, yeah, yeah, definitely.
Interesting.
So the interesting thing to me, unless you have something else you wanted to add real quick.
No, that is what a PTQ is.
Yeah. So Magic and just the whole Wizards of the Coast tournament format has really, over the last 5 years, moved over the last five years towards making more small tournaments for players as opposed to these gigantic regional tournaments. And it's because of the increased attendance to these things. They know that there's going to be more people showing up. They don't like 4,000 and 5,000 and 6,000 person Grand Prix. They don't like 300 person PTQs. They want there to be between 30 and 60 people. So it's a reasonable amount. And on top of that, an LGS, a local gaming store, can actually run the tournament. What they noticed with like the pre-releases especially was that these giant regional pre-releases were kind of shutting out the business that should go to the local stores supporting their product.
Right.
And I think this is just another reaction to that.
Well, since Magic kind of has blown up in popularity over the last couple of years, Wizards has made a sincere effort to try and, you know, localize everything at LGSs. So, like, you know, PTQs even used to be ran by regional managers of an area.
Right.
And a couple of years ago, Wizards made the decision, no, it has to be attached to a store. Now, in our area, what that just really ended up being is that the regional managers would find stores to partner up with every weekend and still rent out the, you know, Costa Mesa Women's Club or school gyms or wherever they would be and still throw the same basic PTQs. Though, you know, for instance, they stopped doing it at hotel ballrooms in the area, and that probably happened across the board because it became less affordable with it being on a local basis and Wizards no longer giving money for these regional people to start throwing PTQs. This, the new system, is the next step and an even greater step to kind of empowering LGSs to have all of the community and followers around their player base coming to their store. You know, now you're going to have them throwing PTQs or pre-TQs that'll lead to these big regional events that'll happen once or twice every, you know, year.
So the question I'll ask you guys, I'll pose this question first. There's an extremely high amount of variance in Magic, both the game and, to this point, a lot of the tournament system. So there obviously is skill that goes into it, but your skill level is mitigated by the amount of variance that just comes with it's a randomized game. You're shuffling right. Constantly randomly drawing cards. So what this system does by giving you a smaller tournament that you have to ace to go to a larger tournament with a bunch of aces and then ace all the aces, it means that you're going to take a bit more of the variance out of showing up to one PTQ, running really hot one day, and getting that envelope, which people sometimes did. Do you guys think it's better or worse for Joe Schmo, who doesn't play a ton of tournaments, to basically not really be able to spike a tournament just by sheer luck anymore?
I mean, speaking as the guy who is that guy, because I don't go to a lot of tournaments. This was my first PTQ ever, you know, and I happened to top 8 it. And, you know, I had a decent pool. It wasn't great. I did run a little hot. I mean, I'm not a bad player.
Sure.
But the fact that I was literally like 3 wins away from sitting next to Reed Duke and Ari Lax and whoever else you want to mention at a pro tour is kind of ridiculous.
And it's awesome. It's exciting.
It's awesome, but it is kind of nuts. Like, it'd be like going to the golf course, playing 18 holes, and then I'm going to go play with Tiger Woods on the pro golf tour. That it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, it's nice as a dream, but sure. To me, like, yeah, you want to suck the variance out if you want to make it a skill game, right? So to me, I sort of agree with these changes because you should have to be really good at the game to go to the pro tour. You shouldn't be a guy, to me, that's going to go sit. And there's probably a lot of people out there and they have dreams of playing on the pro tour. And you should want to make the pro tour because you're awesome at Magic. You shouldn't want to make the pro tour because you got lucky on one Saturday.
Well, not to mention, so, like, yes, it's true that for us common folk, just spiking and getting to the pro tour is not going to be as possible if possible anymore.
Sure.
But this means that in generally the people that put the work in and the best players are going to be going to the pro tour because you have to do right. That double level thing. And I think we're not making big enough a deal, and it hasn't been made a big deal. Getting to a regional PTQ is a big deal. Like, first off, the first one, you're getting a Liliana of the Veil promo, which is going to be a $300 card because there's only going to be 3,000, you know.
Yeah, there'll only be 3,000.
Yeah, 3,000 of them. You know, you're going to have players that, you know, that's a benefit. It's going to be a little bit more focused than normal, especially if they stagger it. So you're going to have these weekends where people are going to pay attention to it, and you still want a pre-TQ. I mean, that still happened. I think there's going to be a bigger deal than GPTs and game days. And for, like, I also think what's going to become a standard is most of these stores, especially the ones that are going to get bigger pools of players going to them, to make it more enticing to show up, are going to be offering airfare. So if your regional PTQ is in Los Angeles, which for us isn't a big deal, but for most players is like a cool place to visit,
right?
Getting a plane ticket to Los Angeles is pretty sweet. Getting a ticket to San Francisco or Seattle or Wizards is, or Vegas.
It's up to any pre-TQ runner's discretion. They could offer those things. And maybe they will. Hopefully they will. Because I think a lot of people right now are objecting to the fact that they're going to have to travel twice.
Yeah. Right.
Where instead of traveling once. Yeah.
But the first event isn't really traveling.
Because there's
nothing. It could be
if you're a grinder and you're going everywhere. But if you're a grinder, you're going everywhere already. Grinders every weekend would go to PTQ. So it's not like that changes their lifestyle.
Right.
And if you're just a guy who goes to your local game store and would go to the PTQs that were nearby, it's not that much of a difference in how far you have to go for that first one. And the second one is great. Your winnings will cover that trip. Or if they don't, then, you know, you'll be able to go to something that at least has some semblance of, like, I went to regionals. That's something you can say to people and is more impressive than I won game day or I won a GPT.
But is it more impressive than I won a PTQ, which is what you currently would say if you did that?
I don't think it is, but I don't think that, I think the real reason this showed up, the real problem with PTQs was size.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, we went to a PTQ, the one that I top 8ed in, and there was 150 people there, which isn't even that large for a PTQ these days, but it's insane when you think about it.
Right.
Right. Like one of those people. And over the years, the same with pre-releases, they started to shift the prize support in the top 8 down. It used to be if you won a pre-release or if you whatever, you won your pool, you'd get a box. If you won or you got second in a PTQ, you'd get a box. You got 8th in a PTQ and 9th in a PTQ, you'd get a box. They started to scale it down over the years, I noticed. Cascade, the local that would run our events, you would get 18 packs for getting 8th place. 8th place out of 150 people in a tournament that runs like 11 hours, and you get 18 packs.
Wait, the other issue is box. Right. We're top 8. But
plus 3.
The issue comes down to the tournaments were becoming bigger than day ones at GPs.
Yeah.
Like, because there's no way to really figure out a winner for a tournament in less than 9 rounds if there are X amount of people. And that's that's a GP of day one. And A, these places aren't really equipped to handle that many people. B, it's exhausting for someone to do that every weekend, especially if you're a grinder. Like, if I'm a grinder, this is a boon set.
Boonsetter, were you just going to say?
Yeah, Boonsetter.
That's amazing. This is a 4-2 with Flash and Bastel, ladies and gentlemen.
If you catch my drift.
This is a boon because now I get to go to like 4-hour tournaments once a weekend.
Right.
That's way easier to handle
physically
and emotionally. If I'm a grinder, I'm probably better than most people in my LGS anyways. So like spiking one of those isn't going to be nearly as hard as spiking one of the 2 PTQs in your area, or 4 if you decide to travel.
Let me come at this from the other side, because that just getting through 35 or 36 people when a few, even 4 or 5 of those people really know what they're doing, you already have to run hot to be the one out of 35 that gets it. It's already hard enough just to have a good day, have a good pool, play well. You get to that point that to then have to show up to another tournament where every single person at that tournament is that person that was capable of running hot. To me, it's just you play in a PTQ and sometimes you get mulliganed out of one of your matches and you just – that X1 that you had to have to make top 8, you just – that happens.
So, yes, but I also think that's assuming that most people that win these things are just lucky, where like – if you really look at the people that perform the best, most consistently, though, like most of the people that get there, especially the ones that stay, which is what the Pro Tour really should be. It should be the best of the best. Like Austin, who won the last one, top 16, the last GP, did very well at the tournament before he
played. At the top 8 in that tournament and you take me off the list. And all those guys I know have been in top 8s of like.
Top 8s or Pro Tours. Yeah.
Yeah.
Andrew Brown has top 8 multiple GPs. Mark Lolgu has been the Pro Tour multiple times.
Okay. But you're forgetting something that's very, very important. While Magic is a skill game, it's a game. So I do think that there's an aspect to this where you have to say, sure, you want it to be like the PGA Tour, where the best golfers in the world are going to make it because they're the best golfers in the world. And you want the best Magic players in the world to be on the Pro Tour. At the same time, you do want those people who are good at Magic and enjoy Magic, but they don't want to give Magic the 4 extra hours a day of Moto that it's going to require, or like all that extra time that frankly is a little bit unreasonable if you can't make it a major priority in your life for a lot of people. I'm not saying that it's wrong to do it. I'm saying that it's a little bit unreasonable if you have a busy life and you want to do this to be able to. I think it takes a little bit of the fun out of it for someone like me who doesn't have the time to do it. And I want to be able to show up. And I want to be able to show up and actually have a chance to – maybe I ran hot at that PTQ and I won. But I'm just not going to have a chance at the point that I have to do that twice against, in the second one, a full room of grinders.
I guess I would say to that is like, let's imagine the NBA or the NFL,
sure,
and you had a chance to make those teams. Would you hold those establishments in as high esteem as you do? Like, that's LeBron James and Kobe Bryant out there. I couldn't literally play with those guys. So I wouldn't want a system where I could, because that would actually take the shine off of the entire organization if, like, some idiot could just walk in on a weekend, shoot a bunch of threes and happen to make them and then get it onto the Lakers. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. It should be the elite of the elite. It should be the cream of the crop. It should be crazy hard to It should be crazy hard to get on the Pro Tour because they should be the best players in the world.
Right. And the other thing is the regional PTQ will be that. You're going, just by showing up, you're getting a cool promo that you wouldn't get on the Pro Tour. You get a plane ticket there, and theoretically, you could be getting plane tickets for these things. And then on top of that, you know, you're going to be playing against the best of the middle best.
Sure. I do think that's true, and I agree with your point about the NBA. It's a good analogy. The issue is that even if you, if a Pro Tour is 350 people or 450, something in that range, right? That's how many people show up to a Pro Tour. Even if you went with the old system, you still never had more than, like, 20 or 15 of that 450 that would show up as these, like, sort of blind luck spikes. Like, it was such a small number anyway. You're essentially
almost sort of like a prize to players of, like, a little... Yeah. Well, but the other is like a lottery system almost.
You're almost eliminating the possibility. That's what the new system does.
But GPs still exist. And they added 4 more of them. And they've been adding more every year for the last 3 years.
And they've actually increased the amount of players from the GP that qualify for the
Pro Tour. So now it's X2 instead of based off of rating. And, you know, the full top 8 makes it to the Pro Tour. So now you have to spike a GP, which is difficult, but, and theoretically maybe comparable. But that's still, like, that's something people do. People spike GPs.
Again.
People just show up to those. But that's how many PTQs.
You're still talking about, that's, look, 2 days to make the top 8 of a 1,500-person GP, you're talking about, like, 16 rounds probably, where to make the top 8, you're going to end up having to go, like, 14-2. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible. You're just talking about, it, like, you compare it to that, that's 14-2 for somebody who doesn't play that much Magic at a Grand Prix in day 2 is insane.
I think going, you know, 7-2 at a PTQ is, like, that person's just as unlikely to do that. You know, I mean, honestly, like, I spiked a PTQ, but I've played so much cons, like, you know, I've played more cons than I've probably played any other set. Like, I was practiced for that. It wasn't luck, right? So, and I don't think anybody sitting at that final table drafting was there because of luck. Like, I don't know that you could get
The amount of people that, like,
of 150-person
I PTQ, get lucky and make it are probably, like, small percentage, and if it's sealed, it's because they, like, open just the god pool, which happens very rarely, and they win.
And they don't actually still win. I saw plenty of pools where I was like, how are you not in the top 8? Because
they play badly. Or they make mistakes. On the other side is, you know, if it's constructed or a modern tour, maybe you come up with some combo that no one ever saw, like Jeskai Ascendancy first PTQ, if it was modern, if that was a possibility. Even then, you have to play correctly through the entire tournament, and maybe one out of every year maybe wins that way. Like, very rarely do people break a format by themselves that are not good players. That doesn't happen. And the last part saying about, you know, you can't do that anymore, but should you be able to? I mean, should the Pro Tour really be, like, 70% good players and 30% randos that didn't really deserve to be there and got lucky one day?
Those percentages are inaccurate.
Oh, yeah, those are made up.
Well, let's take this a step further and let's look where these things are actually getting you.
Right.
So you take an average Pro Tour, and like we said, it's between, like, 350 and 500. I don't know the exact number, but it's a high number of players. And we all know the best 20 or 30 or 50 names in the world for the most part. Almost none of these guys, almost none, play Magic exclusively, just play Magic to pay the bills. It's, I would say, like, the tiniest number. Most of them write articles, do a few other things. They do it a little bit on the side. They're very good players. You're talking about, if that's the ultimate goal, you want the best of the best of the best to be able to make it to the point that they can go play this game to not pay their bills, to fly to another country. At that point, it's still a hobby and still a game. And I understand we want that to be as competitive as possible. However, unless this is something where it is the PGA Tour and I can make $150,000 a year playing Magic if I just make the Pro Tour, if that's the end goal and Wizards makes that possible for us, by all means. This system makes perfect sense because you're really aspiring to something that really, in your real life, outside of it being a game, means something. This is still at the highest level a competitive card game. And I don't think you can take away the dream from a kid who's playing a game to play the game at the highest level.
I would go back to my NBA analogy, because early days of the NBA, like, those guys were, like, John Havlicek was, like, a cab driver on the offseason.
Right, they didn't make a lot of money.
Yeah, and we're in very early days of what would be professional esports, professional game playing in general. We're lit, like, in the
literally the
yes we're
first
in the
5 years maybe
yeah we're in the very early stages of it. So I think that, like, you have to project moving forward. You have to say, and how do you get to the point where John Havlicek turns into Dr. J, turns into Magic Johnson, turns into Michael Jordan, turns into LeBron James, right? How do you make those steps? You make those steps. All those steps along the way were created by
one thing:
setting the standard.
Television contracts.
Yeah, but it's setting the standard of excellent, excellent
play. Yeah, but that's
also
going away. Like, eventually these things will, like, sponsors will show up eventually. People realize, oh, there's a million people watching this every weekend. Right. I can pay this player to wear my t-shirt so that we can, you know, get our brand out there. Those things will start happening once viewership gets there. And to get viewership, the better the players,
the better the play
and the more consistent. Because to be totally honest, yes, the best thing for the Pro Tour is having pros that you recognize.
Sure.
It makes it so like, oh, this is actually a game of skill, because it's proving that the same people are doing well, meaning like you actually have to be skilled at it.
Right.
And B, recognizing people. Like, you know, the reason you like sports or competitive play and watching it is because you associate with something or someone.
Right.
Like even tennis, which is the most similar, or golf, both are very similar to what Magic is and how pro players and tournaments are kind of run. Where it's not a team and there's not a league. It's like there's one people just go
individual sports. Yeah.
You still, like, there was the Andre Agassi's. I loved Andre Agassi. There's Pete Sampras. Love Pete Sampras. There's Nadal. I don't know any golf players.
But if those tournaments included, like, rando people that had won a tournament in...
That you never heard of.
Like, it would... Like, Wimbledon is Wimbledon because only the best of the best get to play at it. And when you win Wimbledon, you had to go through this gauntlet of the best players in the world to get there. And so I think that's what they're aspiring to. And I totally get it. And I get your point, Ben, and I don't disagree with it, which is that there is this dream... And I'm a total casual player. Like I said, I went to my first PTQ. I've only played in like one GP. I'm like the opposite of you. I just don't have time. Like it's not that I'm bad at Magic.
I'm in the same boat.
Yeah. And it's like, I've played a lot of Moto recently, but I don't generally have the time to do that. But it's nice to have that dream. It's nice to be like, man, if I just won three, you know, more matches, I'd go to the Pro Tour. But it's not good for the game ultimately, I don't think.
Right. Well, and so this all kind of is talking about like how it affects the individual player. There are two factors we haven't really brought up, and we brought them up a little bit. I don't think the PTQ system as we had it was sustainable. I don't think
From a size,
yeah. If we got 10% bigger as Magic, the PTQ system wouldn't have survived.
Yeah,
there'd be 12.
And it was going
That 14 round tournament that GPs are,
right?
That would be a PTQ. It'd be 12 rounds, but it'd be on one day, which is not physically good for a human being and not physically possible by TO standpoints. On top of that, the thing that will help Magic do the best is people needing to go to local game stores.
Yeah.
Like, those are where the communities are built. Those are where people play. Those are where people play on most weekends that aren't the day PTQs exist. Or Moto, which is has its own problems. So empowering these stores to have actual legitimate tournament with actual skin in the game, because, like, Game Day doesn't have skin in the game.
No.
GPTs only matter for the 3% of players that are going to go to that GP in the area, unless that GP is in that city that week.
It's fair.
Like, so this is like, actually, I'm going to earn something. This is worth it for me showing up to the store this tournament. And that's very good for them. Yes, it might hurt the one or two stores that used to get the PTQs in the area. But theoretically, they're going to be getting, those are the type of stores that will be getting regionals at least once a year. The other thing you have to look at is, most areas, and even LA, which we mentioned earlier, is huge as a city, and we have actually significant more PTQs than probably most places, at least on the West Coast or the middle of the country, versus maybe the East Coast that has probably a lot more, because it's just much more condensed as a population.
Population density is way higher.
We get maybe 2 to 3 PTQs a season, which is way more than probably other places, which means they get one.
Right.
So this kind of allows these players, if there's one every weekend, and there'll be areas that have low populations, but we'll still be able to pull that off. There's enough stores in the area to have at least a few, and within the travel area of where you live, even more than that. Those players that are good and want to grind will be able to go to enough of these where they can probably, if they're going to win a PTQ, they're going to win a pre-TQ.
Sure.
And then going to regionals, then that's where the PTQ is. Yes, it's a little bit work for that first one, but grinders are grinders. They're grinding anyways. Like, you're saying, like, yes, it's not achievable for you yourself because you're working a lot, or you don't have the time to be playing Magic all the time. But you're the type of person that this probably doesn't hurt that much.
Sure.
Versus the person that hurts the most are these grinder types where they're like, we're really working hard. But in the end, it'll probably be more of a wash than really affecting them, other than the fact that they have to go play at local stores at, like, GPT size events.
Right.
That, you know, will be just more successful around the board, which is better for LGS, which means that Magic sells more because these stores will start holding more tournaments. And eventually, they'll have to compete with each other. buying us plane tickets, giving us larger prize pools. Sure. You know, there'll be people being like, we're having a modern event, and the winner gets Tarmogoyf, and you get to go to the regional event. So, like, those kind of incentives are eventually what's going to happen, and that's probably better for Magic. Really comes down to, for most people I know that play at PTQs, they go because they like playing in major tournaments or big tournaments.
Right, yeah, that's the reason
I go. More of them. They're not necessarily true. As really big, but at least there's more good Magic playing versus, like, I hate going to GPTs because there's nothing in the game. I don't win anything that's in complete at all substantial for going to a GPT.
I do like the idea of showing up to the regional and there's 120 or 150 other people who have all had to win the same mid-level but kind of competitive tournament. And none of you are on the pro tour, but you're all at this. You've all traveled to this one place, and it's, I think that there will be a little bit of a sense of camaraderie. Mm-hmm. Whereas on the pro tour, maybe 70 or 80 of the people or 100 of the people you see, oh, I want a PTQ too. That's why I'm here. And LSV's over there. He's just on the gravy train. That's why he's here. As opposed to these events, it's a pretty competitive event. Everybody had to go through the sort of the same trial by fire, right. Which is cool.
And there's way more. And to be totally honest, these regionals are almost more interesting sometimes than pro tours if you think about it, because everyone's way more in the game to win it. Right. Pro tours, people are in it because there's money in the line, but, you know, there are many of the best players are also Hall of Famers. So if they lose, it's not like, oh, I'm not coming back next year. This is like every single person in this tournament wants to win better than anything else on the planet at this point. So, like, it'll be way more interesting Magic at sometimes even than some Pro Tour play levels, especially earlier in the tournaments.
I wanted to rewind about something you said earlier, because I'm curious, because to me, this system of qualifying for a qualifier actually makes it so that there's less skill variance. More skill variance? No, it lessens the variance. So the grinders actually should be happy about it. Because if what you're doing is taking variance out, then the cream will rise to the top. Because you have to win twice. So I think for the grinders, actually, it's net positive. Like, if you're a grinder, you're already saying, like, I'm better than most players. If you take the variance out of the game, then I have a better chance of winning. Like, otherwise, why are you grinding it out every weekend? I mean, most grinders are just going to be better than your average dude like me that shows up once in a while. And so to them, I just think it's great. Like, they just have, more chances for the cream to rise to the top.
True. I also worry about the guy that shows up and runs hot for, 35, 40 person tournaments and does well and gets that regional invite, and he shows up and just gets smoked because he has just no idea the level of competition that he's going into, and he's traveled and maybe he got airfare and maybe he didn't. But it's always kind of a case of the feel-bads when you just show up and you're just way outclassed. And I do think that will happen sometimes. I think as these events go forward, I do think that the people that win the pre-PTQs are not always going to be grinders.
No, definitely not. I mean, they're for sure not, because they're going to be smaller. And but they got not going to be grinders at every one, but yes.
Like, they get to go to a regional. Yep. Like, that's – right now there's no skin in the – like, no one's, like, cares about that because they didn't exist before. But that's – I think worth something. I think that
it's going to be a feather in your cap.
Right, exactly.
Agreed. That's fair.
Yeah. Especially if, notch, like, on your even axe. If you don't win it, but you're like top eight at a regional and it was small, too small. That's great. That's not necessarily winning a PTQ, but that's better than top eighting a PTQ.
Yeah.
If Josh squawked to the table and was like, I just top eighted a regional, I'd be way more impressed with him than I am right now.
Which is basically like he's not impressed right now at all.
Not at all.
That's okay. I'm not impressed with me either.
So as this is a modern podcast, I kind of want to jump into how does this affect modern as a format? Yeah. And I think there's two kind of sides to look at it. On one hand, there's no longer going to be this force-fed 3 to 4 month modern season. That no longer will exist. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, and I think eventually this will happen more thoroughly, it's a consistent modern tournament player base. Instead of me having to wait nine months, this format's not relevant. Like, last year, I basically didn't play modern for 9 months, even though it's like my favorite format. And I would force myself to play it, like forcing my local LGSs to throw small tournaments.
Sure, sure.
But like, those would maybe fire with 6 people or more. And like, I would just like wait for the PTQs, or like, if there's a modern GP nearby, go to all of them.
Right.
But what this will do is like, once every season, there's going to be one or two stores in my area, especially because I'm in LA, so there's a lot of stores. But in generally, there'll probably be one store that does a modern pre-TQ.
Right.
And I think that consistency, along with the fact that I think it will grow in popularity, and I think what will eventually happen, we were talking about this before that we started recording, the local LGSs, some of them are going to become specialized modern stores. Like, I think it's dumb. For the fact that right now none of these stores in the area are going that first month with the modern pre-TQ.
Right.
If you look down the list anywhere, I mean, 10% or less of the pre-TQs that are scheduled right now anywhere in the world are modern. Like, I mean, I think, like, it varies a little bit by region. Like, I think Russia and some other places have a little bit higher.
Yeah.
But, like, anywhere in the United States, Canada, you know, Latin America, like, it's, like, 85 to 90% standard or something. It's like crazy amount. Very little sealed, very little modern.
And that's because most LGS owners are very risk averse. And so, like, standard is a guaranteed.
Yeah.
You know, it's the most popular format. But if you were the one store in an area that had a modern tournament, you would kill. Get every single modern player. Yeah. Period. Because right. modern players, most of them love playing modern.
And they love playing. Modern, the modern players love playing competitive Magic. Right. That's the point of the format. That's right. the, yeah.
I would also say, like, if you're in the third or fourth week of pre-TQs, you might have just played three standards in a row, and you might just be like, hey, I'll just do anything different.
Right,
like,
right,
so
right.
That's
hey,
why it's kind of crazy.
Bro,
that,
let
like,
me your deck. I need to, like,
play I just got to break it up, man. Yeah. yeah, I just need something different.
And you might see growth. I mean, like you said, I think just the same way we're anticipating the first run of pre-PTQs being way overpopulated, you'll probably see all of those metrics change slowly as people realize, right. I don't want to just play standard every time. I don't need to show up to every one of these. You know, they'll be smaller. There'll be some modern ones. I think Legacy's probably dead, but...
Well, yeah, and we might get a little bit into that before we get into the deck tech. But I think what'll end up happening, and we shot called this, like, in the third or second episode of the podcast, Modern Master 2 is being printed probably in June, or May 30th.
Well, and every pre-TQ is going to be
and
modern.
And I think, like, right after that, most pre-TQ... Not everyone, because store owners are still risk averse, but it would be so surprising if like it went from if it didn't go from like 10% to 50%.
Yeah, because it's like, gonna be awesome.
The hype.
Well, plus
the
sealed at that
everywhere.
Time will also be Modern Masters too.
Right.
Oh, I cannot wait for that.
Oh God, it's
awesome.
I cannot wait. Modern Masters was so freaking great.
I pretty much missed Modern Masters 1. I played like here and there, and Time Spiral is my favorite set ever. And everybody kept telling me this is basically just getting to play Time Spiral again to some degree.
It's Time Spiral, but. Like, arguably better in some ways.
It was more designed for Limited, even. I mean, it was more, carefully crafted around Limited. It was, oh, man, I'll play it right now. I don't care. You
not
guys,
to mention,
I have two
like,
boxes. You guys want to do it after the podcast?
I'm into it.
I could be convinced, yeah.
Well, one thing I want to say as a casual player, as a mostly EDH player, one thing I think that's great is that without the modern season, there won't be this roller coaster cycle of prices for the modern staple cards.
Right.
That, like, is really annoying when you don't play modern as much. You know, when you're an EDH player, it's like, why is this card so much? And then if I just wait 6 months, it's way different.
Like half
but I need it now for my EDH deck, but I just want that price to be...
Well, not even that. It also sucks like, oh, modern's popular right now. I can... Oh, all my friends are playing.
Play
I want to play. Oh, everything's 30% more expensive than if I waited 6 months. Okay, wait 6 months.
No one's
playing it right now. I guess I'm not going to buy cards right now. That seems like...
That is a crappy business model when you think about
right.
it. Like,
so
it disincentivizes you to play when you should be playing.
Right.
And actually incentivizes you to play at the point when nobody else is playing it and therefore you wouldn't want to.
It incentivizes you to be like super, super like smooth and like buy all your cards in the off season. Like something that like no card player wants to do.
Like, there's a reason I got obsessed with Magic finances. Like the only way I can afford this game originally was like to be like, okay, I need to buy when it's low and sell when it's high and like watch, you know.
Right.
But it's very common for Magic players because what are we? We're min-maxers.
Right.
We're people that play it like it's a super high math intensive game. Like we like numbers, jockeying numbers around, finding little edges and advantages. You do that when you're buying your cards too. So all of a sudden, like they set up this system where like it actually teaches me to not play modern when people are playing modern.
Right. Well, I mean, I generally in this last year was a little bit better because modern was during the summer, but it used to be standard season was in the summer, and I would like rarely play in the last standard season because I would sell out in March because it was dumb to hold on to cards past that. You would lose like thousands or hundreds of dollars depending on how much you invested, and this allows it to kind of be like every time of the year it's worth. You know, maybe modern as a whole will rise a little bit. Like, it will consistently be more expensive. But on the other end, you never feel bad for buying cards because it's going to be stable and you get to play with them immediately. Like, I can buy a modern deck right now. And within the next season, even though it's 10%, there will be one or two modern, pre-TQs that I can play.
Right, yeah.
And you don't have that feel bad where you bought it and then you go to sell it a little bit later. And what the heck? Why is it 30% less than it was?
Exactly.
Like, that's what most people want. Like, you know, I'm not going to become a pro Magic player, and I'm also not going to become a pro Magic financier. I want to play the game.
Right.
But I just don't want these feel bad moments where I spend money and then I just felt like I lit it on fire.
Right. And we've talked about this before. Modern was meant to kind of replace Legacy, mm-hmm. and that's because Legacy is cool. Modern is cool. You get to play with awesome spells that do yeah. crazy powerful things and do like crazy intense kind of magic playing. And before this, it was kind of like you had to, you could only do that during the PTQ season, and beyond that, it was kind of like there was no real support for it during the year unless like a GPT or a GP happened to be nearby you. And so now this really incentivizes Modern as a format to become much more of a like grassroots on the floor, not just Pro Tour grinders kind of playing it, and like regular people will start playing Modern more and more often.
Well, and within 5 years, like 85% of Legacy is going to be legal in Modern because they just keep printing. I mean, every new set is legal in Modern, right?
Right.
So
right.
And year by year, a couple more Legacy cards will. Oh, you know, like I mean, for instance, you guys remember like when Grim Lava Mancer got reprinted, for
right.
instance, like. At times, or Rancor gets reprinted.
Scavenging Ooze, or yeah, the more recent one.
These cards, slowly but surely, they get reprinted, and the only ones that won't get reprinted are cards that are just ridiculous and unfair and unnecessary in Modern.
Or on the reserve list.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, and it's a very small number, ultimately. So, really, you will have most of the like Legacy. Modern will kind of become Legacy without the just really unfair, broken turn one wins.
Right. I mean, that's kind of what Wizards has been philosophy behind the format, and with Modern Masters 2 coming out, with this new, you know, grassroots level pro play system that's going to be much more available to new players. Like, it really, like, most players don't play in PTQs.
Right.
They don't. Because right. it involves traveling somewhere. It's a 30, you know, it's X amount of buy-in that you have to, like, plan ahead. You have to wake up at 6 in the morning
it's
and travel 2 hours. It's intimidating. This is way, I'm going to get, like, my younger brother way more likely to show up to this tournament. Because worst case scenario, they're there for 4 hours and they're like, oh, I'm bored, I'm going to go home. And it's like 30 minutes away.
For all the points that we've discussed, I'm just 4 hours versus 10 hours is going to win every time in my book. And I'm so, yeah.
like, seriously.
I work at a bar part time. I often go into work at 6 o'clock on Saturdays. That's like a thing I do almost every Saturday. And like, if I can show up at 10 a.m. and get out by like 2:30, that's going to be so much more doable for me than, you know, having to take the day off work. Taking a car out to San Diego or Costa Mesa, we've all done this dance.
Oh, yeah.
You pick me up at 10 or whatever, and we get coffee, and it's an experience.
If it's nearby, I've gone generally PTQs all like 7 a.m.
Yeah,
like probably average. If it's in San Diego, 6 I wake up because you have to shower, you have to make sure everything's ready. I then have to go pick up the three people I'm carpooling with, and then get on the freeway, and it's a 2-hour drive to San Diego.
And as fun as that is, because it is fun,
right? There is a, I mean, but like.
By 10 o'clock, when we're sitting at eating our Bloomin' Onion at Outback Steakhouse, it's...
You feel horrible.
Yeah.
Well,
I gotta say, during the draft portion of Top 8, my brain was going, you know, wouldn't be the end of the world if you don't win your first match here because you get to go home. Yeah. I mean, you know, right. you don't want your brain saying that. You right. want your brain right. being like, let's right. kill everyone in our path and go to the Pro Tour. But what part of your brain is like... I'm tired, dude.
It sounds so glamorous to like the outside player that's never made it, but like you're usually in like some like abandoned gym or women's club, and there's like 14 people left. Everybody's like sweating and like stinks.
There's no AC.
The bathrooms are closed down. Like
they didn't give you time for lunch.
The janitor maybe a hot dog or a slice of pizza all day.
The janitor's like, guys, I gotta close down. You relocate to Chili's. And,
you know, like, yeah, it's just like looking really good to just lose and go home at that point. Like,
and you know. That's going to a PTQ where it's like risk, like you don't know even. Sometimes I'm just like, oh, there's a PTQ tomorrow. I guess I'll go.
Right.
Where like that's going to be what the pre-TQs are.
Right.
And if I'm going to a regional, I'm like that week eating carbo loading the whole time, like waking every day up at 6 a.m. to like switch my time zone. Like I'm getting ready mentally, physically.
Yeah.
Like I know I'm going to a tournament that's going to be legit. Same as I would if it was a pro tour. So right. like it's kind of giving mini pro tour play to players that aren't necessarily at the pro tour yet.
I'll finish my point because I've taken both sides, but basically my final point on it is I really like the idea of regional PTQs. I don't like the idea of having to win a pre-PTQ to get to them. However, if that's the way it is, I do really like the idea of a regional PTQ. That's where I'll leave it. I don't like that it's going to be so difficult to even get to that point. That's the only thing that bothers me about it is I don't know when I'm really ever going to play in a regional because I don't know how much prep time I'm going to give a pre-TQ, honestly.
Right.
That's the way I feel.
But you're a good player. You played a lot of things. You have a decent chance at winning a pre-TQ.
Especially like when I used to play game days, like I stopped going to game days in these tournaments because I realized that it's just like not worth the time, like a promo and a mat that says champion on it that you could buy the next day for $15 isn't
right.
worth like the effort a lot of the time. But I would generally do decently at those. I'd top four, top or win them on semi the regular. Now I have a motivation to start doing that again. And it's not going to be, it's going to be the same difficulty as a game day, which weren't that like stressful. Right. Like PTQs are like a stress inducing environment. They're really, really fun. Don't get me wrong. Love going to PTQs. But now that stress is a little bit less and my path to the Pro Tour actually exists in a much more convenient manner.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's funny because I feel like as the representative of the casual group here, I should be more towards Ben's feeling because for casuals, I feel like it made it harder for us to get there. But on the other hand, like I've never felt like I was ever going to make the Pro Tour or become a Magic Pro. I've always played for fun. So if it can be slightly more casual at a PTQ, that's actually a plus in my book. It's like the PTQ was fun, but man, everybody's really serious. You know, at one point, like the guy is like, oh, because we were getting your top eight and one of the guys I was playing was like, you know, oh, you know, DC, what do you think? And I was like, I don't know if I'll even go to DC, like, tell you the truth. Yeah. And the guy was like, don't tell me that. You know, do you want to concede? I'm like, no, I don't want to concede. I just, I don't know if I'll go. Like, you know, I'm not going to be, you know, maybe I will, maybe I won't, you know, or maybe I'll just take the plane ticket and go to the Smithsonian, you know.
Right.
Like, I'm not trying to be a professional Magic player in my life. I'm just not. Like, I have a pretty good career. Like,
right.
I'm fine.
You were just gaming him so hard. He was getting in his head.
The dude was so mad, you know. The guy was so mad, and I was like, okay, sorry. Yeah, he totally did tilt, and I beat him, and it might have been because of tilt, too. But I didn't do that on purpose.
Oh,
you know, yeah, I mean, a pre-TQ is appealing to me on the level of, like, what Ben's saying, which is like, yeah, if it's like I like pre-releases better, honestly, because I just want to play Magic.
Right. So
when that gets down to it, I just want to play Magic. Like I just want to go someplace. There's a lot of people playing Magic. Like that's what's the fun for me.
I imagine his feeling is the same feeling as me sitting across from somebody and being like, "I'm going to beat you today with Grand Architect and Pili Pala," and it's going to feel great. just like so unsettled.
I mean, I feel like what it really comes down to is one of the great things about pre-releases is they're semi-large tournaments that are semi-competitive, but you also have fun at.
Right.
One of the problems with GPTs and Star City IQs and game days and all of these, like, the next level of competitive play events is that they are all kind of worthless. They're all based off of, like, you going to smaller other tournaments. Where this, like, is what a PTQ was, which is we're putting you on the path of a Pro Tour.
Mm-hmm.
But you also get to play, like, at these local LGS-style tournaments. So you get, like, it's putting a credence to this size of tournament that has never existed before, and it makes that interesting to me.
Fair. Yeah. Totally fair.
And when it comes to Modern, I think the fact that we're going to have regular once or twice a season Modern tournaments instead of begging LGSs to do small, crappy Sunday morning, three people might show up, eight people might show up, five people might show up Modern tournaments, it's going to be a lot better and easier to foster a community around the
format. And the last part about that, just to add on to what you're saying with getting to consistently play Modern all year, one of the most frustrating things in the world, if you recall, was us driving home from a PTQ gimmicking up that, like, kind of like Hate Bears deck.
Yeah,
that we were
Hate Bears so, with Crucible. Yeah,
and we were so excited about it, but it was the last event of the season.
Right.
So we didn't ever get to play the deck because by the time it rolled around again,
we spent 2.5, maybe 3 hours building a deck, testing it, like,
with, and there's no,
like,
more events.
In the car using, like, Goldfish apps. And there's not another event, and by the next year, we're just like, I'm not excited.
I mean, I have to say, like, I've been listening to the podcast, and I got excited, and I was, like, building an affinity deck, and, like, and then I was looking around for, like, where would I play this thing, and I just found, like, nothing. So I was like, why am I going to build this deck? I get to play against you, Kessler, and that's it. It's one-on-one.
The great thing that Wizards did during the last Pro Tour was they made two announcements. One is Friday Night Magic can be any format you want, and
but it's just going to be standard.
But it will be standard.
Well, no. But
it's just like the Model
A store
T.
can fire as many as they want. It used to be limited to only two possible FNMs per FNM per store.
Oh, they can have like a Modern corner. Yeah,
you're right. Have as long as a 8-man will fire, you can have a tournament. So they can start throwing FNMs in Modern without the risk of what it was before, where it's like, well, if I can't have standard and draft, then I'm losing money and I'm ostracizing players. Well, now, no, you're not. You have those, and you also put Modern up that you can play. The other thing is this, which allows, you know, these regional PTQs and these pre-PTQs can be Modern formats semi-regularly, and therefore people will be able to play Modern more than just the three PTQs that they go to during the summer every 9 months.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing you said earlier, too, that I wanted to just underline for people is, like, how you said that you sort of, like, pressured your LGS owner to, like, do a Modern tournament once in a while. Like, I don't think people right. really understand that that's something that you can do. Like, be in communication with your local gaming store owner. You know, they're receptive. You're their bread and butter. Like, you know, I know a lot of people, they don't want to sort of ask for what they want, but like, your customer, go in there and be like, hey, we should have a modern event once in a while.
Right.
And you'd be surprised like how often that will cause the store to like have Modern Thursdays or right. like, and all it has to do is do like good one time. And the you know, your LGS owner is going to be like, sweet, let's do this all the time.
Right.
You
know, something that I've been encouraging now the many LGSs in our area to start doing is something that they do at every GP and PTQ, where they would have sign up sheets. They just have a clipboard with Modern written on top and 8 names, and you sign up, and if it fires, you pay, and then that's a tournament. And if every FNM has that, you're eventually going to get like the people that scrub out a standard or draft, or people that just show up and are like, and especially if people get used to it,
they're like, they know it's going to be there.
Yeah, it's going to be there. That people sign up, and Modern will start just firing naturally because the store doesn't have any risk. Then they're not announcing it. They're not planning on it. It's just like, this is available to players. We're advertising it, and if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. But they're standard in FNM.
That's
so
a great
come
idea.
To the store. So, okay, so now that we've kind of covered the subject for the day, tournament play and all the changes that have happened, let's get into the deck tech.
Okay, looks like we're doing black, green, X, which kind of used to be Jund.
And now is Abzan.
Yeah, Abzan, one of those wacky new descriptive.
They actually have an Abzan card in there now.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, it used to be called Junk. So what black, green, X is, it's black, green cards, and generally it's a mid-range deck. It's like the classic example of a mid-range deck, which is like efficient threats, efficient removal spells, discard normally, and generally a lot of 2-for-1s or value cards that just put you ahead card by card, eventually digging into your opponent into the ground.
The first thing you notice when you look at these kind of decks, and this is easily like coming from the brewer side of things, the most frustrating thing about a deck like this, every card's good. Every yeah. single card you mm-hmm. draw, every single card you play is going to be a good card. They don't play any bad cards.
I mean, in our game plan, I literally have in caps, play all the good cards and discard.
Yeah, like you. If I play a narrow strategy that's maybe in more powerful with a combination of two cards, but you just thought seize me, every card in your hand is still better than the rest of my hand because my strategy is void.
Right.
So anything clever I try to do, whether it's a combo or a tempo deck, is just not as good as yours.
Well, the classic game plan of Jund, and Jund was where it kind of started. They go through the history of the deck. The deck showed up in the format as Jund was Thoughtseize or Inquisition of Klozak, one mana cost discard, followed by Tarmogoyf or Bob, either card advantage or just a beater that's bigger than
plus
everything else.
Plus it works
else,
with that discard.
Which works with the discard, now bigger. Followed by Liliana, which will just start locking you out of the game. Followed by Bloodraid Elf, which will gain them so much advantage that there's no way to beat them.
And of all the decks that they banned cards from when they originally, you know, did the Modern ban list, this is probably the most recent deck that had been good in Standard that kind of got to live in Modern.
Like, right, Jund, it didn't get any bans. Well, because it originally was, it's a hard deck to ban out because it's all just a bunch of
value
cards.
Right.
Like, even, we've talked about it before, Bloodraid Elf shouldn't have been banned.
No.
Like, it took a bullet for one card that was too good, and that's why for almost a year, Jund was 50% plus of the field, which is ridiculous in Modern.
Right.
Was
Deathrite Shaman. Right. That card needed to be banned.
That card needed to go away. But in reality, it's just removal spells that are good and efficient, creatures that are good and efficient. Like, there's not, like, you could ban Tarmogoyf, but Tarmogoyf doesn't do anything inherently, like, it's just big. And, like, necessarily not even right now because of Scavenging News, it's not even the best 2-drop green creature they have in the deck.
I mean, you ban Second Sunrise because that strategy doesn't become viable without Second Sunrise. You can't just ban good cards because you're just going to print other ones to do the same thing because, right. like, they're just good. That value cards will always be printed in every set.
And so, you know, then it went through bandings. They did ban Deathrite Shaman. They followed that ban with Bloodbraid Elf.
No, I think sorry. It was the other way around. But yeah, they both got banned eventually.
And Jund now kind of has been this weird existence where there have really been actually three versions of the deck. There's been black-green decks, which are, you know, just playing the basic shell of Abrupt Decay, discard Liliana, and they'd be able to play, you know, more straight-up mono-black cards like Phyrexian, not Negator.
Obliterator.
Phyrexian Obliterator, which just is the nut sometimes. You know, Jund decks, classically, which is basically that deck, but you're playing Lightning Bolt and better Manlands.
Right.
Or Junk, which has kind of become Abzan, and since it's become Abzan, it has actually become pretty much the dominant of those three different archetypes in Modern. One of the reasons for this is on the back purely of the Rhino. Siege Rhino.
Oh, that card.
So a couple weeks ago, you know, GP Madrid, we saw multiple copies of the Siege Rhino in the top 8, And one of those decks was junk. You know, Black Green X is still around. People thought it was dead because they thought Tarmogoyf wouldn't be as good because Treasure Cruise makes it worse.
Yeah.
But in reality, the Rhino kept the power level high, and Scavenging Ooze is still good. You know, Bob is probably not as good. Dark Confidant has lost value.
Right.
But now they have Courser, they have the Rhino, they have, like, they have the 4-drop that what Bloodbraid Elf used to be.
Right.
To the extent, actually, I think the fact that Siege Rhino is as good as it is in the deck makes Bloodbraid Elf even more likely to be unbanned.
Sure.
Because
now you have to make a choice.
Now there's a choice. No, there's that, like, the argument for Bloodbraid Elf staying banned was that it made it so that Jund was the deck you had to pick.
Right.
I don't think that's true anymore, which is great. That's when, like, you want to have to make choices, and that's what Wizards wants, diversity in the format. And so by unbanning Bloodbraid Elf at this point, you have to choose between the Rhino, which is bigger but gains a specific value, or Bloodbraid Elf, which, you know, is smaller but haste, like, has the same drain 3 basically, but also can gain huge value or no value. Like, in an Inquisition of Kozilek onto a deck, an opponent that's top decking isn't good.
But I mean, I don't know a ton about Modern, but Siege Rhino seems incredibly good.
Oh, yeah.
6-point life swing, can't be lightning bolted.
Can't be killed with Abrupt Decay.
Yeah, it just seems very, very strong. It's amazing that it sort of took this long for it to really rear its head.
Well, there was actually no major Modern tournament
with
heavy pro play between it being printed and GP Madrid. But there was a few 5K tournaments, and most of those just saw that, like,
the same decks as usual?
Well, no. Well, completely changed game. Complete metagame change. So Delver was dominant.
Burn was dominant.
Yeah. Ascendancy was a new combo deck that was just, like, blowing people out of the water that weren't prepared for it.
Yeah, I mean, Siege Rhino just seems very good against decks that try to win with lightning bolts and, like, diddly little spells.
Right.
It's just, it's bigger and beyond most of your efficient removal.
Before we join the rest of the key cards, I do want to bring up the fourth archetype that has never been very good, but theoretically is the last version of Black-Green, which is Black-Green-Blue.
Yeah, they've tried before.
This deck has been around in the format. You know, in Legacy, is actually much more of a deck because they gain value with Shardless Agent, which is like mini Bloodbraid Elf.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But what this deck is really trying to do is, you know, it's the same thing, but they have Snapcaster Mage. And that generally goes with Cryptic Command. The problem with the deck generally falls in is that the second Thoughtseize is not nearly as good as the first one many times.
Right.
And on top of that, you know, Cryptic Command, your mana becomes very difficult. It doesn't really go with the rest of the cards because everything is gold.
Yeah, I was going to say, Cryptic Command feels like it would just screw up your mana all to hell.
Right. It's really what it comes down to is your mana concerns just skyrocket. And every player I know that's kind of played it, because a lot of people I know tried switching into this when Bloodbraid Elf was first banned, because, like, oh, what do I play? Well, Snapcaster Mage is kind of like Bloodbraid Elf. And their opinions on the subject was just like, I feel like I'm being punished continuously. Like, every mistake I made is so much worse. It's like playing a mid-range deck and a control deck that's not, doesn't have the strengths of either of those.
Well, and the last, because the last thing you look at, I mean, if you name cards in this list, almost every single one of these is played tapping out in your main phase, occasionally leaving one mana open. But that doesn't leave you room to leave open Snapcaster Mage,
and Mana Leak.
I mean, that's the whole deck, right? Play something good. What do you got? Play something else good. What do you got?
Yeah, and you don't want to be having to play the game where half your cards are sorcery speed and half your cards are instant speed. It's just bad. It never works.
Well, then you're telegraphing everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. That totally makes sense. I would think that this discard stuff, because the discard package is pretty robust here, right? Liliana, Thoughtseize, Inquisition of Kozilek.
Somewhere between 12 to 14 spells.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me because, I mean, reading about Modern lately, just keeping up on the format, like, Treasure Cruise is such a big thing. It feels like you're just fueling their Treasure Cruise. How is that not a thing?
So I think it's not as good as it used to be.
Uh-huh.
I think they get around this in two ways. A, discard is not the worst still against Treasure Cruise because you can hit Treasure Cruise. I mean,
oh, that's a good point. You just be like, oh, discard that thing.
Yeah. And then the other side is that the decks have Scavenging Ooze. And so what Scavenging Ooze lets you do is kind of mitigate their graveyard. It's one of the few decks in the format that can play legitimate graveyard hate main deck. Yeah, so a lot of the junk decks right now are main decking Graveyard Hate beat on top of the four Scavenging Ooze with Relic of Progenitus or Spellbomb. Right. So, like, these are ways that, like, you draw a card and you're getting rid of their graveyard. Great. And more often it's Spellbomb because you get to keep your Tarmogoyf.
Right.
So that's kind of how the discard works. The other thing is, like, Liliana is so powerful against decks that aren't Treasure Cruising.
Mm-hmm.
And the decks that are Treasure Cruising, it's definitely lower, and you would probably side some of them out. But the other side is that then it's just a removal spell that
you
gets
kill
around
Delver.
Stuff. Yeah, you're just like, I make you sack two creatures. Yes, you're getting your Treasure Cruise because you're whatever your things, but I also get creatures that I can now Scavenging Ooze. My Tarmogoyf is bigger for the few turns before you start Treasure Cruising. It still gives you advantage. Like, Liliana is so powerful that now that it's not great, it's still one of the most powerful cards in the format.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the best way to put it is, I don't care how many cards you draw if my cards are better than yours. basically.
Right. Yeah. Right, right.
I mean, if most of the cards in black green are just gonna be more powerful, then you know, Delver is situationally really good, and Snapcaster Mage, you have to have something in the graveyard, and Treasure Cruise, you have to set up. Like, Seadrown is just a 4/5 that helixes you and is big.
Right, and I think that's why Junk has come across, because the two cards I think really help are Seadrino and Lingering Souls.
Yeah, Souls is so good.
And both of those are great. Well, one of them's great against Delver. The other one is great against everything, because it's bigger than the format. And
gains you life and hurts them, too. Yeah.
I
mean, this may be a stupid question, because why isn't Thragtusk somewhere around here? It feels like it would be.
There were a few lists of pod playing Thragtusk at GP Madrid. Uh-huh. I wouldn't be surprised. The issue becomes it's very hard to get to at 5 mana.
Oh, it's just that one extra mana.
It's that one extra mana doesn't help you a lot, especially in a deck that like is about efficiency, and the 4-drop is really where you need spells. I can see maybe playing one, especially in the sideboard.
I've seen older lists right. used to play.
Well, especially when Blood Braid Elf went away. Yeah. It was one of the first cards people tried out. It's a little slow if you're not potting into it.
And so it's now like Rhino is basically that, but a turn early?
Exactly. It's literally what it is. It's that Rhino is this. It's what the deck needed, which was a 4-drop version of
Thragtusk.
I mean, the thing to point out about this deck, that if you're a listener here and you're trying to kind of put your finger on, like, oh, well, why is this card better than this other card? The point of this deck, it's not a perfect science by any means. The reason that you talk about four different versions of it is because when a card like Bloodred Elf gets rotated out, there's 5 different 4-drops that everybody's trying out to replace it with. It's just this will shift every time cards get printed every time.
And I think Seadrino is the first card really that can just fully dominate that slot. I think before that, you know, sometimes people would not play one. Like the black green decks, even I mentioned Phyrexian Obliterator. But, you know, the deck started kind of not playing that even. Like, the 4-drop slot wasn't important. Eventually, what Jun was playing was Chandra, because Chandra and Corsair Crucifix, which we didn't mention, but is kind of one of their major card advantage engines, together is awesome.
Well, but when Bloodbraith Elf got banned, you had people trying Olivia Valdarin, and you had people trying out Huntmaster of the Fells. Like, and honestly, Huntmaster of the Fells is not bad. Like, none of those cards are bad. They could all, you could put them all into a list, and they'd all be marginally just fine. They just probably wouldn't be as good as Seadrino.
Right.
That's the point of the deck. It's just a bunch of pile of value advantage cards.
Like, everything is a 2-for-1. And you know, on top of that, it has, like, some of the best broad removal. So, you know, we've talked about in the podcast before, one of the reasons Birthing Pod is so good is it's a 4-drop, and that's because Abrupt Decay is in the format.
Mm-hmm.
Abrupt Decay is one of the few cards that literally answers everything in Delver. I think that's one of the reasons they gain back game, is that Abrupt Decay and Liliana both give them value against counterspells, because Liliana Veil, if it lands, they no longer can, especially if you're on the play, you play it on their turn 2, they tap out for any of their many 2-drops. And you now just have a Liliana the Veil that's going to make it so countering your cards are going to be hard, because they can never keep cards in hand.
Right.
If you're playing against discard, they can't have counter spells in hand. And if you're playing Abrupt Decay, it doesn't matter.
So yeah, beyond that, you just have a pile of removal spells. Maelstrom Pulse, Lightning Bolt, Path to Exile, Dismember, Golgari Charm. I mean, versatile cards that do everything, that answer everything. Yeah, I mean, and then you mentioned Corsair is kind of the other card that we... Oh, and I guess Manlands. That's...
Right, so kind of the last bit is Jund has a very good selection, and Junk both have a very good selection of manlands among the best of the one color ones, which is Ape
Treetop Village,
which is a 3/3 ape for 2 with trample. And you know, if you're Jund, you get the Raging Ravine, which is just a giant beater that, you know, eventually you're just going to get there for them. Or if you're playing Junk, you get the green-white one, which is decent and blocks Delver all day. It's a 3/4. So, like, and it blocks Restoration Angel. It blocks all of the major flyers that you need to really worry about. And getting in for, the reason Restoration Angel is good is because it's a 3/4.
Right.
So it's a 3/4. Great.
I think it also, the old Jund list always would play Lava Claw Reaches as well, just more manlands.
Well, that was when it was in Standard. So Lava Claw Reaches was the manlands they would play over, because they didn't have Treetop Village. So now that you have 4 Treetop Village, 4 Raging Ravine, that's your manland suite.
Sure.
When there wasn't Treetop Village, they'd play like 4 Raging Ravine and 2 Lava Claw Reaches, because you'd want maybe the one or the 5th or 6th. You know, the last kind of card, we mentioned some of them, are like the card advantage cards that are purely what that is. It's kind of what Bloodbraid Elf was. It's what Bob was until recently. Bob has gotten much worse. Bob is Dark Confidant.
Right.
And Dark Confidant used to be very good, because if you got online, you just won. But now in a world of Delver, where every single deck is running cards like Gutshot in the format, it just is no longer, like, you're not going to get a single card off of it, because everyone just has Lightning Bolts, four of them, and Snapcaster Mages that you're playing against.
Right.
So instead, people have kind of eschewed to Courser, which they are already starting to play, which just lets them, you know, smooth their draws, lets them gain card advantage,
gain life,
and is a 2/4 that just blocks everything and doesn't really add a lightning bolt.
It's so good.
And, you know, if they're playing Jund, they were playing Chandra, which comboed with Courser, and it was really just to gain card advantage. This deck does so much better when it's starting to draw cards, which is why Bob was so good, that having answers that kind of allow that to do it is really good. Now they have Siege Rhino, which lets them just go over the top. They have an end game that's just more powerful than what people are doing. And I think that's kind of where the format's at, where, like, having these big spells is what's necessary to beat cards like Delver that otherwise will get under you and beat your face.
So it's clear it's a big pile of good cards. It's variable in its colors. It always kind of starts with green-black. Let's kind of run through a few of the decks in the Gauntlet, see how it fares. So we've actually talked a little bit about Delver. That's one we keep talking about. And Blue-Red Delver being one of the better decks in the format. Maybe the best deck in the format, honestly.
I definitely think it's heavily overrepresented. I think it's what Jund was back in the day, it's like going to be 40% of the field, and if you're not prepared to beat it, you have to.
So this deck's pretty well set up to beat Delver.
Right. I think that's why it did well, is that Rhino is a good answer to Delver. That's why the pod decks, every deck that did well at the GP was playing either Tarmogoyf or Rhino, and this deck plays both.
Yeah, it can just the combination of Abrupt Decay and Liliana, and I guess Rhino to some degree, but Rhino is still counterable. But Liliana, which comes down a turn earlier and is a nightmare for them if you can resolve it. And then, especially Decay is just so good. Decay is like the worst nightmare for them.
Not to mention Scavenge. I mean, we've talked kind of in the deck because, like, we have to focus on this. There are so many ways for it to fight Delver. And Scavenging Ooze, Abrupt Decay, Rhino, like, Golgari Traum is nuts against them.
So good.
It just destroys Pyromancer.
Yeah. So many good cards.
Lingering Soul is really good against them. It's a very powerful deck for this. It's really tuned to beat Delver. You have to be in this format. That's kind of
you can't beat Delver. That's level zero. That
right, yeah. Exactly. The next level is Birthing Pod. Birthing Pod is generally one of Jund's worst matchups because of Birthing Pod.
It's a more clever value engine than what you can get.
Exactly. They have a slightly better beatdown plan, and they have a slightly better value plan, and your cards aren't that good at stopping what they're doing.
Right.
Like, all of their creatures are removal resistant, especially to your removal. Birthing Pod doesn't die to Abrupt Decay, so you really only have one answer in the deck, especially main Pulse, deck to it, which is Maelstrom Pulse. So it's definitely a deck that gives you a little bit more trouble. I think, you know, coming into sideboard, that's why you have more graveyard hate. Scavenging Ooze is really important in this matchup because it eats up all of their value creatures before anything happens. And I think that's why Junk is slightly better. Junk gets you the good sideboard hate cards, like, they get Stony Silence out of the sideboard. They get these cards that really help them in the matchup. And so I think that's where they're getting a little bit more points than they used to be. But this is going to be a hard matchup because they also have Rhino. So your Rhino is way less powerful than it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, that's you look at these two decks, and it's like most decks. If they get an active pot against you for two turns, you're probably not going to win.
Right.
If they can chain that, that's the story.
Too much value.
That's the story of the year with pot. That's why for a long time people were talking about pot should be banned when it was the best deck, because pot is just, if you can get an active pot. And that's, this deck does have a decent turn one against them because of Thoughtseize. But right. Inquisition's the same as Abrupt Decay.
Well, and I think the reason that this deck did so well at GP Madrid, or one of the reasons, is because it didn't have to face Pod. Pod, before that tournament, was considered a duck, along with this deck. Both of them walked in the tournament being relatively unknowns for the first time since the format existed. And it didn't win because it left that entire field that it was built to beat, got to the top eight. Oh, like, look, there's these other decks that are also built to beat. Oh, and they're kind of good against me also. There's two Pod decks here to deal with. The next matchup, Affinity.
Yeah, now this one, I feel like we say this every single week when we talk about Affinity. It comes largely down to who goes first.
I think this is the one matchup where it doesn't. I think actually you're heavily favored to beat Affinity.
No matter what.
Not no matter what. I think Affinity is still an aggro deck that will get you, because Affinity is an aggro deck that will get you. That's how it's built. It's what it's meant to do. But A, you get, I want to say 70, if not 90% of the good hate cards in Junk. You don't get the red ones, but you get the white ones, which are the best.
Stony Silence.
Stony Silence. On top of that, you get the ability to just, your deck is filled with removal spells. Like, the problem Affinity has is when cards, and it has Abrupt Decay, which is the best answer to Skullclamp. Not Skullclamp. Skullclamp.
No, not Skullclamp.
Yeah.
plating. Cranial plating. Yeah.
Abrupt Decay, which is the best answer to cranial plating in the format.
Yes.
Like, so, like, it really puts them on the back foot more than any other deck does because they have the removal main deck to kind of handle it. And discard's not terrible against them because turn one or two, you still grab that cranial plating. You still grab the Edge Champion. The cards that most decks have the biggest problem with, you can get rid of. And you can just answer their smaller
threats. So what you're saying is that even if you do go first with Affinity on the play, all right, that's the same thing. What you're saying is that even if you do go first with Affinity, you're still probably not favored.
I think Affinity can win. I think this is its toughest matchup. And I also think that it comes down to what they have. And I think Sage Rhino just makes your plan worse. I think Lingering Souls and Sage Rhino just wreck Affinity.
Oh, I forgot about Lingering Souls. Lingering Souls is maybe the best card against Affinity.
Yeah, I mean, like, I played Esper once in a PTQ, just being the subject, and my game plan of Affinity was just I had four Lingering Souls, and they just can't beat it.
Yeah, it's really hard.
It's just like a deck that card is just the end. So moving on. So there's a good matchup for you. Splinter Twin. I think this is the thing where your discard.
Well, your discard and the fact that every single one of your removal spells, I mean, for goodness sake, Abrupt Decay.
Right.
It wins. Right. Just wins outright.
I think that's something we, like, now that we're in here, we didn't talk that much about, but Abrupt Decay is one of the reasons this deck exists. I think that's the reason black-green is the combination that we talk about, is because Abrupt Decay is the second best removal spell in the format, if not the best.
Yeah, I mean, it they can't... What do they even play in the main deck that survives it? Do they play, like, some sort of, like, Apostle's Blessing type of card that is, like, protection from?
Nope.
it's all soft counters, like Dispel and stuff like that?
They get you by you tapping out and shutting your mana off, and then at the end of your turn playing a spell and then going on. Or the really way they get you is generally you hold your Abrupt Decay for when they try doing it, and they just tempo you out. Like, their game plan against Jund is to tempo you. That's actually why the Tarmo Twin decks got popular, is because those decks were meant to fight you on a tempo basis.
You're just bashing you, and right. You're like, I'm going to stop the combo, and you're like, wait, I'm dead.
Oh, there's a Tarmogoyf coming
out. They never comboed me out. Yeah.
I think this matchup got less bad. Or no, I think this matchup got worse for junk decks or Abzan decks or mid-range decks because of Dig Through Time. Because now at instant speed on their turn, they go find it, they play it, and you lose.
So if you ever tap out, you could just...
Yeah, this is a matchup where tapping out is a mistake, especially once they have Dig Through Time mana. Or X cards in your graveyard, whatever way you put
which
it.
Which is, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Ascendancy, which I feel like we tool every week, is the next one that we're going to talk about.
Well, you always want to point it out just because it is a deck that if you're not prepared for it, you won't beat it. But I think this is a deck that is, in the sense that, like, Abrupt Decay, once again.
Very good. Your card is awesome.
Right, Abrupt Decay, you know, you also have removal spells for all their birds and little dorks, and you have one of the few removal spells that sees heavy play in the format that can kill a Caridid, which is Liliana of the Veil. Yeah. So, like, you can mitigate what they're doing to you, and in the meantime, beat them down with the Tarmogoyf. And they're not going to stop you because they don't have cards that interact with you in game one.
Now they actually don't care about that at all, right? They're just like, I'm going to combo out or I'm not. I don't care what you're doing.
Their game plan, game two, they do bring in Leyline of Sanctity, so you can't target them with your discard. So that is something you have to be aware of. And in game two, I would generally take out my discard against them. Mind you, I don't think their discard is that good. I think your discard is the worst in this matchup anyways. Because, yes, you can hit Ascendancy.
Yeah,
but
I was going to say, it doesn't feel like it should be.
But every card in their deck is a cantrip. Every single one. So it doesn't matter. Who cares? Yeah. They're like, okay, I don't have this Ascendancy, but I have seven copies of it in my deck, and the rest of my deck is draw spells.
Right.
So, like, their bigger issue is that your removal spell is very strong against them, and you can stop them with Abrupt Decay. So you just, like, holding that Abrupt Decay for Ascendancy, oh, they go off, stop you.
So I would say that I think the last deck we're going to talk about, Scapeshift, probably the worst matchup, right?
Yeah, this is the matchup where your sideboard has a pretty large chunk of guaranteed slots against them because you need them to get... You have three Fulminator Mage minimum just so you can deal with them as a matchup. They are very difficult. Your game plan a lot of the time is just partly to race them, but the nice thing you do have is discard. Discard is good against combo decks.
Right.
It just happens that Scapeshift is a deck that kind of goes over the top, and this would be the one deck I'd be the most worried about pretty much entirely if I was walking into a tournament with this deck would be Scapeshift.
Yeah, Scapeshift just wins out of nowhere. It's super frustrating to lose to.
It's also like, it's one of the best top deck combo decks in the format. Yeah. Like, Twin can't win once Liliana starts doing stuff. It literally cannot win because they can't land spells without you getting a chance to remove it. But Scapeshift can top deck Scapeshift and win that turn.
Right.
Regardless of what you've been doing.
Like, you could stop them for 20 turns and then they'll still beat you out of nowhere.
So I think the takeaway from this...
Play Scapeshift.
Yeah. It seems like, you know, mid-range decks that start with black-green are going to always have a decent place in the format. You can never show up to a tournament playing one of these decks and feel like you're totally outclassed. It's just that particular week.
Right, even the bad matchups, you still have the best, most efficient aggressive threat ever created. Like, Tarmogoyf still comes down on turn two and in four turns can kill them and end them.
Yeah.
And so, like, yes, it's a bad matchup, but all the bad matchups we described are still not the worst, and it has such good game against a lot of the field that there's a reason this deck was 50% of the field. And yes, it was because on the back of some of these other good cards, but those bannings still never got rid of it. All it did was made it so you had a choice between colors.
It's not like when you say Ascendancy has a bad matchup, and a bad matchup for Ascendancy is like an auto lose. Like, there's, you know, there's decks that you just will beat you, like, right, no question. This deck doesn't have any deck like that that it can.
Right. I mean, and the other side is, like, we just went through the gauntlet. These are arguably the six best decks, this being the seventh best decks in the format. And it had a bad matchup against one.
Yeah, no, it's true. We didn't really say a whole lot of negative.
Two, with Birthing Pod. Like, and that's why Birthing Pod was the second most popular deck in the format for years, because Jund was the most popular one.
Yeah, 100%.
So let me ask you, if I was going to learn to play this deck, what do you think are, like, the biggest things? Because I'm looking at, like...
Tarmogoyfs.
Yeah. First of all, I'm looking at the fact that it looks expensive. But secondly, like... You know, all the discards seems like the skill ceiling on this deck is pretty high because you have to know what cards to take from your opponents. Like, it doesn't look like a good deck for me starting out in the format because I would have to know so much about the format to know what the heck to take out of their hand when I play these cards, right?
We always say that testing is the most important thing when you're trying to get good at a format at all. But the beauty of this deck is, and we talked about this last week with Andrew Brown, he basically said the reason pros like to play decks like this is because their win percentage is high enough. Their win percentage is high enough that they can use their skill to push it over the top. But it has an intrinsic level that's high enough. Even if your opponent draws just poorly, you might just win because it's full of good cards.
I'd actually argue the opposite side.
So versus, you just actually just play this, right. Sometimes,
like,
you just win?
Yes, the choice of what you're going to take from your opponent's hand with Thoughtseize could be difficult. But when it comes down to it, it takes a very brief overview of cards in this format to really know, like, okay, I'm playing Splinter Twin. I know what that deck is. Like, the decks are pretty established, so you can pretty much be like, okay, for Splinter Twin, I need to take this card.
Yeah, like, or it's like if you're up against, you know, you're going to play a Tarmogoyf on turn two and they have a Path, you probably just take Path so you can kill them with Tarmogoyf.
I think the most difficult matchup playstyle where the most decisions are important is probably Delver, but the point is that Delver is going to be such a large field that if there's one deck you should be testing and learn your way around the matchup, that's the one.
So you would say this is good for sort of a more beginner.
That's kind of the issue with Modern and why a lot of people can... The best deck for beginners is this deck.
Oh, cool.
That's the deck most pros, and the reason it was so popular for so long and so prolific, especially in Pro Tour play, is because pros feel the most comfortable just playing this deck. It's like, okay, I get it. I don't have to study for months. I don't have to specialize in a deck. It's not like Twin where I have to know every single in and out of when I should move the tempo, or when I should be comboing, or when I should counter a spell. What's relevant? It's just like, I play my spells, I get Liliana the Veil in play, it starts making it so they don't do anything, I beat them down with Tarmogoyf. It's a very simple game plan.
Yeah.
The problem...
I want to build this deck.
Right.
Where can I get cheap Tarmogoyf?
Modern Masters packs.
That's not cheap.
Yeah. Win a tournament where they're giving one away.
Win a pre-TQ where they're giving one away. Yeah.
Actually, to be on that note, I wouldn't be surprised if... So we know that Liliana the Veil is the next big promo. I wouldn't be surprised if Tarmogoyf ends up being a regional PTQ promo.
But that's not going to change the price at all. I mean, there's 3,000 of them. Like,
right, but you can get to a regional PTQ when you get into the regional PTQ.
That's the whole point.
There's the easy one.
Good point.
And you'll get one out of four.
Well, no, you get it automatically.
You need three more.
I mean, you'll get one out of the four you need.
Oh, yeah.
But then, honestly, you could probably just sell it and get, like, all the rest of them.
Right, because it'll be foil and promo.
Oh, cool. Right.
It'll be worth like three or four times as much.
Right. I have one Tarmogoyf. You can borrow. The other one is borrow from friends. If you're like, Tarmogoyfs aren't good in this tournament.
I don't know if I have any friends.
So call Alex
that good.
If you need a Tarmogoyf. He's willing to lend it to you.
Yeah. That's kind of the gauntlet, and that's
pretty much our episode.
Yeah, the episode. So I want to thank Josh for coming out.
Yeah, thanks
guys. It was fun to be here.
Yeah. Why don't you tell everyone about the Command Cast and the Command Zone and how to find you?
Oh, yes. The Command Zone is our EDH podcast. I co-host with Jimmy Wong, who you may know from Video Game High School.
He was also on the episode 3
weeks
ago. He
was also, yeah, just on. Well, we're good friends. We play a lot with you guys.
He'll be here later tonight. Not on the podcast, but we'll be playing some
magic. We'll be throwing down some EDH, even though Ben doesn't think it's a real format.
That's going to be edited out.
You can find us also on rocketjump.com, where you find this podcast, or you can just look on iTunes for The Command Zone, or you can follow us on Twitter. At CommandCast. My own Twitter is at Josh Lee Kwai.
Yeah, follow that. My Twitter is at Kess Wiley, KessWylie. And Ben Bateman doesn't have a Twitter. He has an Instagram that he wants you to follow.
Wait, no. Ben's got a Twitter because I follow it.
Yeah, I have a Twitter. It's EDH is not a real format. No, my Twitter is Ben_Bateman, and my Instagram, please follow it, is Ben Bateman Media. That's I use that more often.
So, yeah, and, you know, I want to bring this up every week until, because this is the last week you have a chance to do it. Jimmy, a friend of the podcast and co-host with you, is raising money currently for Band-Aid, his musical web series. You can win a jet ski or a car.
This is no joke. You can win a jet ski or a car.
He's giving it away because he won it himself, and he feels like giving it to you so he can make his passion project that's going to be awesome and very funny. Is going to let you get a jet ski.
Jimmy's really funny, so you should try to win the jet ski.
I want a jet ski.
Well, the show's going to be sweet, too. I mean, if you just look on Indiegogo and you click on their video that's sort of like, what do you call it? It's just the video to sell their Indiegogo campaign. Like, just that video is awesome.
Right.
So, like, you know the show's going to be, like, 10 times better than that. If you've watched Video Game High School or anything on Rocket Jump, you know the quality level.
And it's supposed to be, you know, the same crew, some of the same cast members as Video Game High School. So that's the kind of quality you're expecting, which is crazy high. Like, this is a web series that achieved so much that it's on billboards in Times Square. Like, you're
literally.
Yeah. So, like, that's what you're kind of expecting, and you can be a part of helping that get made.
Plus, you can win a car.
Yes.
Jet skis are way cooler than cars.
And the last thing we wanted to throw in there, guys, was that our question of the week is, what do you think of the new PPTQ or pre-PTQ system? We talked at length about it. What do you guys think? Let us know in the comments. We'd like to know.
Yep, on rocketjump.com, or you can just tweet it at us at VMMcast.
Or on my Instagram. Just kidding.
Take pictures of your view on the new pre-TQ system.
Write it down on a piece of paper, take a picture of it, send that to Ben.
Cool. So, that's everything. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, take care, guys.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.